Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thanks, Melissa. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm John Fort, in for Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead with the markets off the highs. Don't chase the crowd. Our market guest says we all know how that ends. He is betting on what he calls the most underrated methodology instead. He's going to be here to tell us what it is and the names to buy using it. Plus, shares of Alphabet higher on a report that Apple's looking to license Gemini AI. Is that a desperate move on Apple's part or just smart positioning? We will have the latest. And home builder sentiment just turned positive for the first time since last summer. We're going to talk to one player in residential and commercial real estate, ask if he's feeling the same sense of optimism. But we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu with those numbers. Dom?
Hey, John, it's a bounce back from the down day that we saw on Friday to kind of close out the week. And we are green across the board for the major indices. The Dow Industrial is up about 128 points, 0.3%. It's the underperformer today for the value blue chip index. 38,843 is the last trade there. The broader S&P 500 is currently just at 5155, up 38 points, 0.75% gain there. So very respectable. But to put that in context, at the highs of the session, we were up roughly 58 points, down 30 or up 37 at the lows. So again, a very positive session, but tilting towards the lower end of the trading range so far today. And the NASDAQ composite currently at 16,113. That's up about 140 points or maybe just about 0.75% upside there. So again, green and technology is leading the way. John mentioned some of that Apple and Alphabet dynamic because of that Bloomberg report about a possible partnership or licensing deal. That's got Alphabet as one of the top performing stocks in the S&P 500 and NASDAQ, up about 5%. Apple, meanwhile, up 1.5% as well. NVIDIA very much in the news, part of that Mag 7 trade because of its big AI developer and kind of computer chip conference going on in Silicon Valley. It's down 0.75%. And then Tesla getting some love from analysts again, and because of a price target, or rather Model Y price hike over at Tesla. So those cars going up in prices helping, and Meta Platforms being aimed at top pick over at Mizuho, up 1.75%. That's the large cap, mega cap tech trade. And then just keep an eye on a couple of these stocks. It's Supermicro and it's Deckers. Both of these stocks are spending day one as members of the S&P 500. They both run up a lot going into this. But now Supermicro giving back about 10%, maybe a bit of a sell the news type situation there. Deckers Outdoors just about flat on the session. So keep an eye on those two stocks. John, I'll send things back over to you.
All right. Two very different stocks, but something in common today. Dom, thank you. Our next guest says the market is pricing in unrealistic earnings growth at this point, that investors should stop chasing the crowd. Instead, he's looking to some dividend aristocrats to position in from here. Let's bring in David Bahnsen. He's chief investment officer at the Bahnsen Group. David, good to see you. So I guess my worry would be if we're talking dividend growth, you miss out on a lot of young software names. Is that intentional?
It is for us. I mean, we really believe that cash flow is king, and we think that the dividend growers through time and their avoidance of a lot of the bursted bubbles that happen with the alternative end up doing far better. And we have tons of track record to prove that. But I think that ultimately, right now, people have actually gotten away with this recovery trade since the 2022 meltdown. There's been some names that have come back quite a bit. Now you see some of them. I mean, I think Tesla's down over 50% and Apple is in double digits down, all the while NVIDIA is still just climbing vociferously. Those things don't tend to end well.
But at the same time, if you believe that this AI thing isn't just a flash in the pan, it's not the metaverse, you know, it's not blockchain necessarily, that really it's going to change the way business happens, shouldn't you allocate some portion of your portfolio to names that you think have some sustainable advantage there?
Yeah, but I would recommend doing it at something that isn't trading at 50 times forward earnings, or assuming that margins will hold when revenue is up 10 times from what it is now. Margins don't hold with that kind of revenue growth. And so, for example, there's a dividend-growing name called Broadcom that we own. It's gotten expensive. We have a lower weighting, but we've owned it for years now. It's very exposed to AI. IBM is exposed to AI. Texas Instruments. These are dividend-growing names that have real cash flows that don't require you to buy into something that's up, you know, 250% in the blink of an eye. That's what I'm concerned about, is the momentum chasing.
Outside of tech, you also like Amgen, Johnson & Johnson, and MedStream Energy ETF. Pick one of those for me and tell me why.
Well, I picked the Johnson & Johnson and Amgen because I wanted to be as boring as I could when we're talking about NVIDIA. You talk about Johnson & Johnson growing a dividend for 65 years in a row. It doesn't get anyone excited. But you know the beta is less than half of that of the market. It may be time for us to get back into more low beta, very dependable cash flow growth. Amgen has grown the dividend double digits for over 10 years per year. I mean, that's massive internal growth. These biotech names have become great dividend growers. Midstream Energy is just absolutely a phenomenal high income, high growth of income story.
Do you think about international in this environment? I'm looking at some of these India ETFs, looking at the growth of the youth population, the big nationwide adoption of digital and payments technology, and wondering, well, it's had quite a run too, but the demographics don't seem to be slowing down.
Yeah, we view the international story as something that takes a real macro look, meaning is the best way to get international exposure companies that are based there or companies that are perhaps based in the U.S., U.S. accounting, U.S. governance, U.S. maturity and sophistication with capital markets, but nevertheless 50-60% of sales coming from these markets. So there's a very global story with a lot of U.S.-based companies. India is doing great locally, but you have to translate that to a bottom-up story. You can't go buy an ETF for Minnesota. You can't buy an ETF for Texas. But there are companies in Minnesota, companies in Texas. We view it the same way with international markets.
Okay. So back to your call here that you got to avoid investing strategies that simply buy the stocks that go up. Are you at all betting that stocks are going to go down? And is there a thought about what is going to be the catalyst that drives that moment for the markets?
Yeah, no, we're not betting anything. I don't want to bet against the market going higher because NVIDIA could go up multiples from here.
Yeah.
I just know how it ends. I know how these trades end. We've seen it over and over again. I've tried to devote much of my adult life to studying bubbles that burst. And I really believe that good companies can get into a bubble. We own Cisco now. I bought it at about $18. It's in the 50s. Cisco is right now 30% lower than it was 25 years ago. And yet 25 years ago, it wasn't like its business deteriorated. It's done nothing but grow. It's improved every year, revenue, earnings. It's a great company. What's the problem? It was just too expensive. I'm a child of the late 90s. I grew up professionally managing money there. I see in NVIDIA some of the same risks that played out there, John. That's the story for us.
All right. David Bahnsen, I appreciate you joining us here on The Exchange. Let's talk energy now. Oil prices up about 1% with Brent crude hitting the $86 mark for the first time since November. And this comes as the S&P Global kicks off its annual CERAWeek Energy Conference. Let's head down now to Houston, Texas, where our Brian Sullivan is standing by there with Shell CEO Wael Sawan. Brian?
Yeah, John, I mean, thank you very much. And in fact, I mean, this is really the epicenter of energy in the world right now. And welcoming in Shell CEO Wael Sawan. Wael, thank you very much for joining us. I want to combine two things that we just talked about on CNBC. It's NVIDIA. They've got this huge conference today as well. Jim Cramer is going to be sitting down with the CEO. And I bring NVIDIA up because AI is everything. And all I ever hear is that AI is going to drive all this demand for electricity. We get most of our electricity from natural gas. You happen to produce and sell a lot of natural gas. Is there an AI discussion to be had around Shell, or am I just completely out of my mind?
No, I think there is definitely, Ryan, a big discussion to be had about just energy demand growth in general, whether that's crypto-related, AI-related, or the multiple other realities around just population growth in countries like China and beyond, and so around the world. So what you currently have is a significant pull on more and more electricity that's coming in, as well as energy in totality. Companies like Shell, as you rightly said, indeed are the biggest players in LNG, but we also have a lot of domestic gas production, which we also sell into the grid. I think we are going to have a bigger and bigger role, both in terms of supplying that energy, but of course also using a lot of the AI ourselves, given we still work on things like the subsurface in the Gulf of Mexico. Those are all great opportunities to be able to become much more productive in the way we work.
Yeah, because when I think about energy, and that's what we're talking about here is energy, okay? There's oil and gas, but we're talking about the need for this. And 10 years ago, it was all about the transition. Now we're talking about energy scarcity, energy security.
Yes.
We want to build all these data centers. We want to make sure people have light and heat in places like India and these other developing markets. When I look at your LNG, Shell's LNG forecast, you see 50% growth over the next 15 years. Where's that coming from?
Three key areas I'd point to. One is continued growth in LNG that is substituting out coal. That plays out in areas like India, areas like China and beyond. Secondly, you have a few countries, many countries actually, that have the infrastructure for gas because they depended on domestic gas production. With time, they no longer have those resources. So they're having to import LNG to be able to use the infrastructure to keep powers in the home. And then thirdly, it's energy security. The realities of what happened in Europe after the Russian invasion of Ukraine is that now we need to be able to bring LNG from afar. Those three key drivers are critical ingredients to be able to see that 50% bump up in LNG between now and 2040.
You're a global company. You, before this, as the CEO, you ran the LNG business in Qatar and worldwide in the Middle East. We just announced a pause in U.S. LNG exports. Now, we're still planning to double those exports with the projects that are currently underway. From Shell's perch, is that going to hurt the U.S.'s competitiveness in supplying the world with LNG?
I think in the short to medium term, there isn't a specific issue to be worried about. Longer term, there might be, depending on where the polls goes.
These are 20-year projects.
These are 20-year projects, exactly. So it's not a short, medium-term issue. My bigger concern, however, is that LNG from the U.S. and LNG from Qatar, those are the two biggest sources of LNG. Anything that undermines confidence in those supplies will always create some nervousness in the markets. And therefore, what I worry more about is the softer elements of the polls to a market that I think needs confidence and comfort into the long term and not just in the short and medium term. And so we hope that this gets resolved over the coming months into giving the sort of clarity that I think the market will very much value.
You know, it's funny, people that don't come to this conference, they see, okay, oil and gas, and now there's a lot of renewables. We're interviewing NextEra for tonight as well. They don't realize that the climate and climate change is a huge topic of discussion here. People think, oh, you're just ignoring it. No, it's a massive topic. I read a headline in CNBC, you might have heard of CNBC, that Shell had just recently watered down your climate goals, going from 15 to 20% from a hard 20. Have you watered them down?
No, we haven't. So I think we have been very clear we are committed to the 2050 target of net zero. What we have said is in 2030, we have a package of targets and ambitions that allow us to be able to both monitor the pace of our progress and allow our shareholders to know what we're doing. What we have done on the net carbon intensity, the one where we have moved from 20 to 15 to 20%, is we have said strategically we are shifting from selling power to homes, an area we have tried to do but haven't been successful in, and we've sold out of, in particular in Europe. So we are reducing the growth in the power sales we had anticipated, which is why we are part course correcting. We also, by the way, added a new ambition, an ambition to reduce the emissions from our oil product sales over the next 6 years by 2030.
So you're still committed net zero 2050?
Very much so, with interim targets to allow us to get there, but we're going to do it in a way that focuses on the areas where we have competitive strengths, and we're going to make sure that we are focused and not betting too many different plays, focused on the four or five where we think we have a differentiated ability.
I had the pleasure of going on your huge hydrogen facility in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, which was just unbelievable, by the way. Hydrogen is a huge, not only is it a big topic, well, it's also a little bit of a controversial topic. A lot of people say it'll never be economic, it'll never work. Other people say it's the future. right? We've got the Inflation Reduction Act. I'm not going to ask you to dive into U.S. politics. What is the role of hydrogen in the United States? Is there a role of hydrogen in the United States?
I think, firstly, there's a massive footprint already of hydrogen today in the U.S., albeit gray hydrogen, and that will, over time, need to get decarbonized into either what we call blue hydrogen or green hydrogen, let's say cleaner hydrogen. So that role is going to continue to be there. I think there's a lot of views that try to polarize the discussion between is there or isn't there a role. The reality is the role will grow.
Yep.
Over time, the more we have green power, the more we have solar and renewables, wind as well, the more you're going to have access to available electrons, which one day can feed into an electrolyzer that produces the hydrogen. So I don't think it's a question of is hydrogen going to play a role. The question is when will clean hydrogen start to become material? I think the answer is more 2030s, if not 2040s.
2030s, if not 2040s. But it's being invested in, I know, billions by you guys as well. I saw it with my own two eyes. Wael Sawan, CEO of Shell. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having
me. And have a successful conference. Guys, by the way, John, we're not done here. Tonight, we've got NextEra. We're talking renewables. Got Senator Joe Manchin. We'll talk about energy policy as that. We've also got Ryan Lance of ConocoPhillips, Mike Wirth. We got a big lineup later on today, tonight live on Last Call, as well as tomorrow. And John, did you like how I see how I did that? I wove in NVIDIA. We're contractually obligated to say NVIDIA in every segment now, I think. So I got that in.
It was like crochet. You were weaving in NVIDIA and environment and all kinds of things. And that's not all, Brian. Thank you. You're going to be back tomorrow with the CEO of SLB, the company formerly known as Schlumberger, live from right there at CERAWeek. That's going to be 1 p.m. Eastern right here on The Exchange. And for now, coming up, Google might be the king of digital ads, but one analyst says Meta is coming for the throne. Those shares are up nearly 40% so far this year. But he's going to tell us why he still sees Meta climbing another 25% from here. Plus, homebuilder sentiment turning positive for the first time in nearly a year, but affordability remains a headwind. Later on, we're going to get a C-suite view from one real estate developer. The Exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Shares of Apple and Alphabet both higher today on a report that Apple's in talks to put Google's Gemini AI system into iPhones. Deirdre Bosa joining us now for today's tech check. Dee, some people out there are framing this as a sign of Apple's weakness, that they don't have their own AI ready to play. But if Apple can make hundreds of millions or billions of dollars off of Google, just placing them here, I don't see the downside.
Well, I wonder, John, do you think that's enough, hundreds of billions of dollars, when we're talking trillions here, when we've seen the rise of NVIDIA? I guess it sounds like a lot. But I've also heard some people say that if you're not actually leading the way in developing your own AI, you're kind of just calling it in. And is that going to be enough in the next platform shift? I think that we got so few details. We don't exactly know how this is going to roll out. Maybe Apple is leaning on Google's Gemini while it gets its own large language model, Ajax, up and ready and able to handle a lot of that. So we don't know. But I agree with you. I think a lot of folks here, especially in San Francisco, don't think that Apple's just going to sit this out.
I mean, we've seen this before. Apple at first used Google for Maps. And then did Apple Maps and really built that out in a pretty impressive way, to the point where now the features are pretty competitive. If they do build Gemini into the iPhone, Apple still gets a lot of data on exactly how people are using it, what kinds of queries they're putting through. It could help them build their own while they're getting paid by Google, could it not?
Exactly. And I think that's what I'm hearing as well, is that maybe this is sort of a temporary solution. Jim Cramer this morning pointed out on the Best Buy earnings call how they said that the Samsung Galaxy AI-enabled phone, the demand was materially more than they expected. So it is potentially that Apple is looking at that and saying, we need a solution right now. But Apple's never the first mover, right? It tends to perfect its technology, its products, and come out there. So maybe this is going to follow the same thing. However, you know, we have a lot coming up in the next few months. I know you're watching closely, John. I showed this chart earlier on in the day, but it was basically Apple versus Microsoft versus Google over the last month. And you can see how quickly the perceived winners and losers in this AI race in the market are changing spots with each other. With Alphabet's huge move today, it was up 7% at one point, surpassed Microsoft in terms of performance over the last month. When you look at what is coming up over the next few months, you've got Microsoft Build, you've got Google I.O., you've got Apple's WWDC. There's a lot of catalysts that could once again sort of change all the calculus in this race.
Yes, and perception not always equaling reality. Deirdre, thank you.
Yeah.
Let's pivot now from AI to ads when it comes to the digital advertising space. Our next guest says Meta has got the edge over Alphabet. He raised his price target on Meta by $73 today because of that. For more here, let's bring in Ken Gorowski. He is the equity analyst and managing director at Wells Fargo Securities. Ken, does this possible Apple deal change the calculus on Google and possibilities for AI revenue for you?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. We don't think it changes our overall outlook in terms of the preference for Meta versus Google and on the advertising side. But I would definitely say that this is a sentiment positive for Google, where I would say post the Gemini release, the sentiment became pretty weak here. But I don't think there's any question that Google has leading AI technology, and they've attracted and retained some of the best engineers in the world. But we see on the ad side real potential for Meta to continue to outperform Google.
What's the driver for Meta now? There was a period a couple years back with iOS's tracking changes and with kind of the resulting crumbling of the direct-to-consumer flywheel around customer acquisition, where it looked to some people like Meta was in trouble. So what's driving their progress now that the methodology for so many companies and how they use Meta's, Facebook's, Instagram's ads has changed?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There was a period of time there in 2021 and 22 where signal was degraded overall in the ad ecosystem, and Google was actually a net beneficiary at that time relative to Meta. What we've seen over the last couple of years, and this really manifests itself in the back half of 23, and we think in continuing to 24, is where Meta has rebuilt its signal, one. So it's the best in terms of its ability to target users and to drive conversions and continue to capitalize on these massive audiences they have there. So they've done a tremendous job there. And then I would say second here, and maybe this is underappreciated, is that the engagement gains. So during 21 and 22, we were a period where TikTok was gaining engagement and was gaining share of engagement and was a real driver of social user base engagement and advertising, and those share gains have stopped. Meta has fought back with its Reels short video product, and the interesting thing is this has become a real content. I think it's Google, Meta is less of a social network and more of a content recommendation engine at this point.
Here's my question though about the longer term call on Meta. If you do get Apple building Gemini into the iPhone, if you do get Google through Android becoming one of the main conduits for AI-based search and thus AI-based signal on what people are interested in, does Meta, with Llama and with its existing platforms but without a mobile device, have enough advantage to keep Google from then accelerating past it?
Sure. Great question. So I would say Meta has four platforms with more than a billion users right? And that includes two messaging platforms that have relatively limited monetization at this point and a ton of signal, right? So I think there's nobody that is better positioned than Meta in terms from data, user behavior. And we know that Meta is building its own solutions and has recently released some Meta AI bots that are garnering certainly some early interest.
Is the metaverse spend ever going to come back as an issue, or has Meta's core business performance been so strong that investors can just forget about that and not worry about it?
Yeah, so I think you're correct in the assessment that the core business performance has been really impressive, and not only from a cost and a margin efficiency, but also from a revenue performance. In terms of the overall costs and the operating losses at the Reality Labs division, we expect them to peak in 24, although we don't see a meaningful decrease. We do think that that they will continue to push along this effort. If you saw Mark Zuckerberg's interview post the recent Apple release, he seemed to be in a fighting mood to me.
He did indeed. He fights both literally and metaphorically. Good to talk to you for all that perspective. Ken, thank you. Ken Gorelski.
Thank you.
Still ahead, we're going to go live to NVIDIA's developer conference with a look at the next generation of its AI technology. Whether its record demand can continue. The Exchange is back after this.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson with your news update at this hour. President Biden spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu earlier today to discuss the developments in the conflict between Israel and Hamas. According to the White House, it included efforts to ramp up humanitarian assistance to Gaza. As a report suggested, almost half of Gaza's 2.2 million residents faced catastrophic levels now of hunger. The call was their first conversation in more than a month. Newly reminted as Russia's president, Vladimir Putin warned NATO that if it intervened in the war against Ukraine, it would mean nuclear war, and that only he could determine peace in Ukraine. Putin's threats come in a post-election speech after he won a virtually guaranteed vote over the weekend, with about 90% of those votes in favor of him. The Environmental Protection Agency today announced a comprehensive ban on the carcinogen asbestos, which is still used in brake pads and chlorine bleach and kills thousands of Americans annually. The ban is a major expansion of EPA's regulations under a 2016 law that tightened regulation of thousands of toxic chemicals found in everyday products. John, back to you.
Tyler, thank you. Now coming up, can office to housing conversion solve the affordability crisis? We're going to look at the numbers and talk to a developer leading the largest conversion project in the country next. Welcome back to The Exchange. The Spider Home Builder ETF, ticker XHB, about flat, slightly positive today, despite sentiment increasing to an eight-month high. Diana Olick joins me now to look into the data. Diana.
Well, John, home builders are calling demand brisk in March, and that's why builder sentiment rose to the highest level since last July, finally crossing back into positive territory at 51 on the National Association of Home Builders Index. That is the fourth consecutive monthly gain, and 50, of course, is a line between positive and negative. Now, of the index's three components, current sales conditions rose 4 points to 56, sales expectations in the next 6 months rose 2 points to 62, and buyer traffic increased 2 points to 34. regionally on a three-month moving average. Sentiment rose most in the Midwest and West. Now, the report also said fewer builders are resorting to price cuts in order to boost sales. In March, 24% of builders reported cutting home prices. That's down from 36% in December and the lowest share since July. But the average price cut remains around the same at about 6%. They are, however, still using sales incentives like buying down mortgage rates. And while builders are feeling better about demand, they continue to cite supply-side challenges, including a lack of buildable lots and labor, as well as new building codes that increase builder costs. Material prices are also rising again due to more demand, especially lumber. John?
And Diana, that's why I wonder, how sustainable are those incentives, given that it looks like we're going to have higher rates for longer, so the relief's not going to come from that side, and the costs don't seem to be going down much from here?
You know, it's shrinking margins for the home builders, definitely. And we actually spoke to the chairman of Lennar recently about this. But he said you have to buy down the mortgage rates, you have to do the incentives, because he believes that the demand is there. And as long as you can get them in the door at an affordable price, at least an affordable payment, then they will buy. And he thinks demand is just going to increase as we get into the summer months as well. So, again, it's a question of affordability and what the builders can handle, how much they can cut off their own earnings in order to cut down, you know, whether it's prices or the incentives, and specifically buying down the mortgage rates.
Yeah, I guess the best operators will be okay. Diana, thanks. Let's stick with housing, but drill down on the multifamily space now. My next guest is a developer who says that supply-demand mismatch has created what some are calling the forever renter. Older, more affluent, looking for quality. Joining me now is Michael Pastronik, the CEO of Post Brothers. And Michael, you got the biggest office to residential conversion in the country going on right now in DC area, I believe,
yes.
Right? The risk, it seems to me, in those projects would be just, do you end up with an apartment that's too small or that feels like an office? Is the conversion price too high because of labor? Have those things come into balance now in this market?
All great questions, and thank you for having me. So, in general, the best conversion opportunities are really not about the existing structure. They're really about the land. Housing prices have, for both for rent and for sale, have gotten very high because of a lack of developable land in the areas where people want to live the most. So the most interesting part of this office conversion opportunity set is not really the structure itself. It's the land value and the ability to get land in these otherwise undevelopable locations. So if you're able to buy the building favorably, which generally is a significant discount to the previous office owner's basis, probably call it roughly a third of what their cost was, then you're able to invest enough in the building to overcome all those challenges you talk about by putting a new skin on the building, by doing ideal layouts, by not being married to existing systems like plumbing or HVAC. You can really start anew. So we've done, coincidentally enough, when we started 18 years ago, office conversions were really our focus. And then over time, we shifted more to new construction. Now office conversions are back. We've done over 3,000 apartments from converted structures. And you wouldn't, if you're in those apartments, you wouldn't say that they're less good in any way than purpose-built.
So when you get them at the right cost basis, you can do some pretty dramatic changes and still make money. So are you licking your chops right now with all of the trouble in office because of, you know, post-pandemic people not coming back to the office? Because I hear that it's not in the newer construction, it's in those older buildings. I'm not sure those are in the locations where you want to build housing, or are they?
They are. If you look at, you know, cities are all different. We've been doing a lot of it in Washington, D.C. We're in the heart of core Northwest Washington, in the Calorama neighborhood, in the Golden Triangle neighborhood. Here in Manhattan, there's opportunities certainly on in very high demand areas. So it is the older buildings, like you say, but for cities that have been built out for 40 plus years, they're in great locations. The opportunities are not as interesting, frankly, in newer cities like Sunbelt areas.
Okay. So in those older cities, are you seeing capitulation yet with, you know, the previous owners willing to say, okay, you know, go ahead, take it off my hands at a third of the price I paid? Or are there still holdouts who are saying, we think that maybe somehow we can make this work?
It's very slow going. I think us and the rest of the industry would have expected to see more transactions by now. There was just a report released by MSCI, which is a big data service. I think it was reported in the Wall Street Journal, that only 3.5% of the office transactions last year in the U.S. were distressed sales.
Why is that? Why haven't they buckled?
Well, I think that a few things are going on. One, it's really driven by the lenders. If an office building is not performing, the lender is really in control. The lender doesn't really want to foreclose. They're not really in the business of owning real estate. So they're doing what in the industry is called extending and pretending. They're just giving more term to the borrowers. The other part of it is I think that data doesn't capture all the transfers that are really going on. When a borrower or a sponsor of a building has fully capitulated and written down their equity to zero, they've effectively handed the keys to the lender, but it hasn't traded yet. So I think because the lender isn't ready to take the discount. So I think there's a fair amount of that going on. So it's taking a little longer.
Right. It's like when you got a stock that's way underwater. You only lose money really when you sell it.
Exactly.
So you try to avoid that for as long as possible. Quickly, is there a triggering moment that you think is going to cause some of these lenders to have to sell what's in their portfolio? Would it take a downturn in the economy overall, perhaps in employment?
Great question. I think what's more likely to happen is an upturn and the lender is seeing an opportunity set. The capital markets are relatively slow moving right now. All of these lenders and non-bank financial institutions, they're in the business of lending money and they want to be doing business. And I think when they see the opportunity set to lend more, that's actually going to motivate them to get these old loans off their books because then they can replace it with more interesting opportunities.
Okay. We'll see if that happens. I know you're waiting in the wings, Michael Pistronik.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, it's been a volatile month for NVIDIA, though shares are still up by more than 12%. Up next, we're going to head out to the GTC conference, loosely dubbed the Woodstock of AI, maybe the Eras Tour of AI as well, for the highlights so far and the big announcements to come. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. Shares of NVIDIA fractionally higher today, pairing earlier gains as its AI conference gets set to start in California. I guess it's already started in a way. Christina Partsenevelis is there, joins me now ahead of CEO Jensen Huang's keynote later this afternoon in overtime. Christina.
A two-hour keynote, and it's finally getting busy. People are lining up on both sides. We already have some protesters, a marching band. But what we know from this is just that there's been such a run-up in the stock, and we saw volatility, like you mentioned, in the share price. Last week, four out of the five trading sessions, the stock was down. But today, and it was up earlier, above 2%. But investors have so much riding in this and so much expectation, specifically more so with NVIDIA's new GPU chip, the B100, which could be at least two times the performance of its previous H100 chip. NVIDIA tends to not disclose pricing, but I've seen estimates anywhere between $40,000 to $50,000 for this chip. So that means it'll be more expensive, which could help margins, but also hurt demand. Other themes for today. We're going to want to hear about other product launches from CPUs to software. We're also going to want to hear about demand from that goes beyond hyperscalers to include government, sovereign wealth funds. Jensen Huang has previously talked about finance, healthcare, all of these other sectors. And then lastly, collaborations with other companies, for example, Oracle. Oracle did allude to a certain collaboration, which is why you're seeing the share price up today ahead of the event. Micron, another beneficiary, since they make high-powered memory chips. Even if they aren't NVIDIA's primary chip provider for those memory chips, just a shout-out on stage could be enough to help the stock, especially ahead of its earnings that are out on Wednesday. You can see the share price is up ever so slightly above 0.5%. And then you have AMD's MI300 AI chip, which could see some threat once we get details on NVIDIA's new B100 chip on stage. NVIDIA is also likely to emphasize its Ethernet switches and their capabilities, which would mean headline risk for a company like Arista Networks. So could see some volatility there. And then lastly, there's some rumors, maybe Intel getting an NVIDIA Foundry deal. No matter how small that deal is, it could bode some confidence into Intel's Foundry business. And we know on Wednesday, Biden, I confirmed that, will be at Intel to provide CHIPS Act funding as well. So there's a lot of other players that could move on this big event behind me. Bottom line, though, today is going to be about NVIDIA's demand sustainability and the transition to AI, since it's only in the, quote, early innings, according to Jensen Huang.
Yeah, Christina, there's a term that investors, AI investors, need to be thinking about more and more, and that is inferencing, getting beyond the training of these models, these artificial intelligence models, to what actually happens once people start using them. And Jensen's been making the case that in the inferencing era, they're going to continue to get a significant amount of business, and there's going to be a lot more usage than there is training, right?
Right, because the last earnings report, we actually were surprised by the inferencing demand. It was about 40% of total data center revenue, which was a lot higher than anybody anticipated. The concern was that companies were going to shift away from NVIDIA when they were using the chips for training and then go elsewhere for inferencing. So that 40% number bodes quite well for that sustainability of demand. Does not bode well necessarily for AMD, because AMD is seen as the likely competitor in the inferencing stage. Also, a lot of these in-house chips too, from Amazon, Google, Meta, they're going to be big competitors in the near term. But I can assure you that will be a topic that Jensen Huang will be speaking about on stage. And that's going to add to that theme that, hey, you know, even if you spend a lot of money on those training your large language models, inferencing's next, and we're going to be at the forefront for that. So that's what we're expecting here, just based off of the last earnings report.
Yeah, even this Apple-Google story today plays into that, especially if the AI calculation is done on device. Of course, Apple's devices don't use NVIDIA chips anymore. They use Apple's own. So we'll see how that plays out. Christina, thanks. Speaking of NVIDIA, Jim Cramer is going to speak exclusively with NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. Eastern, on Squawk on the Street. And by the way, if you missed NVIDIA's big rally but still want to buy some AI beneficiaries, well, CNBC Pro crunched the numbers, found a dozen alternatives that some say are expected to see huge earnings growth going forward. One of those names is Seagate, but for the full list, you can scan the QR code right there on the screen. Go into cnbc.com/propick. Coming up, there's one expense more correlated to insurance demand than anything else, says the CEO of John Hancock. The bad news, that expense is going up. What it is and the other trends he's seeing next. The Exchange will be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. The FOMC meeting starts tomorrow, and rates are widely expected to hold steady this time around, with the market seeing the first cut coming maybe in June. Joining me now to discuss what this means for his business is Brooks Tingle, CEO of John Hancock, part of Canada's Manulife Financial, and one of the largest life insurance insurers here in the U.S. Now, longevity insurance, life insurance, what's the difference? Is that just a better way of saying it, so we think about living longer instead of thinking of dying?
Well, thanks, John. Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, our industry, like hundreds of years, would issue coverage on people and say, geez, John, I sure hope you live a long, healthy life. Because that's a good thing for us, actually, right?
Yeah.
Good for you, too, presumably. For those that don't know, we make money in a really simple way. You pay us premiums. We invest those premiums. The longer we get to do that, the more money we make. And it occurred to us that it's profoundly odd that we never tried to help our customers live a longer, healthier life. So several years ago, we introduced a new program called John Hancock Vitality, and we actively partner with our customers now, providing them with education, tools, and interestingly, incentives and rewards, discounts and goodies and things, for taking steps to live a longer, healthier life, basically promoting their own longevity.
Okay, what's the impact of a higher rate environment then on your business?
Well, generally speaking, higher rates are good for the insurance industry. We lived through a very long period of time. I can remember post-financial crisis, we would sit around in meetings and say, now when interest rates go back up, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. After two or three years of that, we stopped having meetings where we talked about what are we going to do when interest rates go back up. So we don't spend a lot of time now thinking about what we're going to do when they come back down. But it looks as though things are going to be fairly uneventful this week, I think, with the Fed, with perhaps some action heating up in June and beyond. It does seem clear, I think, that somewhat higher rates are here to stay for a bit, even if they tick down some. And as I said, that's generally a positive for our industry.
Now, what is the relationship between gas prices and insurance?
This was quite fascinating. A couple interesting things happened during COVID. I mean, I was always looking for the silver lining. COVID was an awful time in our history and for many of us personally. But it did spur a lot of demand for life insurance. Go figure. People, global pandemic, things can happen. What happens if something happened to me and I did not have the protection of life insurance? So we saw demand really shoot up during COVID for life insurance. But interestingly, when inflation started to really tick up, we started noticing that applications for life insurance below a certain size dropped quite quickly. Hmm. And I had somebody on the team plot the retail price of gas at the pump with life insurance applications below, say, $500,000 death benefit amounts. And you'll never see, John, a chart more perfectly correlated. And it kind of makes sense, right? If, you know, middle America, you sit there and say, geez, I need life insurance. I want life insurance. But if it costs, you know, 30% more at the grocery store or 40% more at the pump, you're going to say it becomes a nice to have rather than have to have.
Got to get this question to you before we have to close. And that's about artificial intelligence. It seems to me like the insurance industry is a prime candidate to do well if they can harness this correctly, no?
100%. And serve our customers better, too. Like I was talking about us playing this unique role in our customers' lives where we try to help them live a longer, healthier life. And we're doing that both in the U.S. with John Hancock and our parent company, Manulife, globally. And you think about what AI could do there as it relates to interventions is a strong term. But if we notice something going on with a client less physically active than they were, perhaps digital nudges and things like that, and using AI to say, geez, we should prompt Brooks to do X. We spent a lot of time and energy doing what we call underwriting people. Somebody applies for insurance. We look at their history, medical history and otherwise, and decide what rate is appropriate. You could imagine AI playing an important role in improving the efficiency there. So quite excited. We're being cautious, as many are, and prudent, but and want to do it in a way that serves our customers well, but enormous opportunity.
Yeah, I like the idea of having those prompts that are good for everybody. A lot of times we think about insurance companies wanting to know a little bit too much, but if you can make some correlations that actually help everybody out, that's better. Brooks, thank you.
Great.
For coming
pleasure.
In. Thank Great you. To have you here on The Exchange. And that's going to do it for The Exchange. We'll see you back here at 4 p.m. for overtime, but Power Lunch starts after this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate. Pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.